Welcome to the Keeping It Real podcast by Real World Academy, where we hear from top educators, entrepreneurs, and creative thinkers on how to design your future.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to episode 7 of the Keeping It Real podcast by Real World Academy. I'm Domenico Randazzo, Chief Operating Officer. We have my cousin, Dr. Anthony Longo, who's also a co-founder and head of community outreach. We have Kamisha Stewart, who's our mental health expert on the team, and our chief strategy officer, Lincoln Farquharson. So last time we all met, we talked about mental health and COVID. And so I'm thinking today we should probably just skip the episode because nobody needs any help with mental health right now. Everybody's cool. Nobody needs any advice. But since we have a doctor on the line, I wanted to first to see Anthony, if you had any insight and any advice from a medical perspective on how to deal with isolation and anxiety and depression, because everybody has a interesting cocktail of all those three issues at this moment.
Yeah, so mental health was fairly poor even prior to COVID. You know, the country was going through something of a mental health crisis, and then COVID has only accelerated what was probably there already. And maybe open some wounds that were not there and some problems that may have not been there, but it has been a problem, continues to be a problem. You need to speak to your doctor if you are experiencing, any signs of depression or severe anxiety.
What are those signs?
So with both of them, to some degree, we all suffer from some amount of anxiety and some amount of decreased mood. But it's when that anxiety or when that decreased mood starts interfering, negatively with your daily activities, with your life. And for depression's sake, it's when you are finding yourself unable to do your work. You're finding your relationships with others deteriorating. You're having thoughts of wanting to harm yourself actively or passively. You're finding feelings of worthlessness, of guilt. And then if you experience those things, you need to talk to your doctor straight away. And if you're feeling like hurting yourself, you need to go to the emergency room. Now with anxiety, it is a little bit different how it manifests. Anxiety manifests as restlessness, jitteriness, inability to get things done, inability to maintain focus on things, uncontrollable worrying about many different things, some things of which are beyond your control, to the point where it's impacting your daily life and that your people are noticing it. You're not able to do your daily activities. Like I said, to some degree, everybody has some decreased mood and some feelings of anxiety, but it's when it becomes severe and you have some of those symptoms that you should think about getting help. Now, for a lot of people, that first line will be their primary care doctor. Unfortunately, we're not in the day and age where everybody can afford to see a psychiatrist or that a psychiatrist or psychologist is even open. There's a lot of, at least in the state of New Jersey, there's a lot of issues with availability. There's a lower number of providers. And there's a need for them, and unfortunately, there's not enough to fulfill that need. And for those who do have a provider, it could sometimes be very very expensive, very difficult to get an appointment. So the whole state, and that's true also for primary care, where there's a lack of providers. But what I would say is you need to speak with your doctor, and like I said, for many people, that will be their primary care doctor or their family med doctor, their internal medicine doctor. We treat it with various different approaches. Some people will have an approach where they need to do talk therapy or cognitive behavioral therapy. And that could be done with the psychologist, with the psychiatrist, and certain providers that practice mental health. There's a good website, psychologytoday.com, where you can actually find psychologists, psychiatrists, therapists that have openings and that are in your community, and you can read about what their different specialties are If you're a, combat veteran, you're suffering from PTSD, there might be somebody who specializes in that. If you're somebody who has severe anxiety, there may be somebody who whose profile fits the background that you're looking for in a, therapist. So you can use that website. Some people don't respond to talk therapy and respond better to medications. There's lots of medications, and unfortunately, they have a bad rap in the community because everybody thinks that it's going to be one of the addicting medications. And to some degree, that there are medications like Xanax, like Ativan, which have an addictive potential, but those are not first line medications. Usually, right. We go with different medications, SSRIs, which are conventionally used as antidepressants. They also function for anti-anxiety agents, and they're not addicting. They're longer acting than the traditional anti-anxiety meds, which are just putting a bandage on a problem, and they stay in your system long term. A lot of people are hesitant to take medications for depression and anxiety because, again, there's that stigma in the community, the bad rap that it gets. The way that I see it, you know, and the way that I've always seen it is that at least for the SSRI, which are your serotonin, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, which are the most basic medications we use for depression and anxiety, the frontline medications, all that they're doing is taking the existing neurotransmitters that are in your brain and making them stay around a little bit longer. The problem with depression and anxiety is that there's a neuron here and there's a neuron here, and there's the chemicals that go in between those two neurons. And the chemicals that allow us to feel a good mood, to feel happiness, or to feel safety, lack of anxiety. In depression and anxiety, those molecules are depleted. They're lower than they should be. And so all that this medication is doing is letting them stay around there longer. It's making them hang around in between those neurons for a longer time. It's not adding something new. It's not putting something in your brain. It's not in that. And I find that with the majority of patients, that they were not aware of this before. They thought we were adding something or doing something new. It's just allowing those same chemicals that should have been there to stay there a little bit longer to the level of where they should be. So from my perspective, it's a great treatment. And those are common medications like Lexapro, Paxil, Zoloft, all of these common medications.
So, you know, it's hard for a lot of people to admit that they're feeling depressed, adults especially. But I think even more so, it's hard to get teenagers and young adults to open up and talk about themselves, especially if they're feeling anxious and depressed. So, Kamisha, in your experience dealing with the youth, how do you tell if someone is really having a problem? How can you extract that without them necessarily being totally honest or open with you? Because I'm sure that's a scenario you come across pretty often.
Yeah, so I find that assessments for clinicians are best facilitated when it's like a conversation, right? If I go through this litany of questions, it kind of puts the client on a defensive. And, you know, for different students, especially people of color and their relationship with mental health, is not very good, right? So there's this expectation that kind of what Dr. Anthony mentioned is that there's this fear that I'll be stigmatized, that immediately you're going to put me on medication. And if they understand mental health just in a universal type of way, then I think they're a lot more receptive. So I just go through a conversation of, you know, what their experiences are, what day-to-day, what are their activities day-to-day, kind of how does their mood fluctuate? Certain situations that may trigger a certain mood versus another. Another thing that I find that a lot of my young people are faced with is that they don't always have labels for their emotions. And so it makes it even difficult for them to identify what they're experiencing because they don't necessarily have a label, right? And the understanding and the imagery of what depression looks like is someone that's probably sitting in the fetal position, that is, you know, malodorous or extremely disheveled, not caring for themselves, and has no functionality. Versus depression can look a variety of ways, right? The manifestation of it could be very irritable and angry, and you're very mad, and your tolerance is very low. What that looks like. How does depression impact someone that's impacted by trauma? And how do they kind of navigate that? And so once we just kind of have this conversation just about like their day to day, just very casual conversation, I start sharing with them just my experiences as a clinician. I do have the ability with a lot of my students, because I have a relationship, for them to have trust in my level of expertise, right? In sharing just my experience and what I've seen, and also just sharing with them just the different presentations of a lot of the mental disorders, so that they can start seeing some of the trends and behaviors that are present for them, and helping to normalize this. I think one thing we find is that when we talk about some of these mental illnesses, is that they're just seem so far-fetched, like it's not possible for me to have it, or they are only associated with a particular community. I have a lot of my students of color that don't think that African Americans or Latinos deal with this particular issue. I don't deal with anxiety, right? Anxiety of what the media has portrayed, what they've seen on television, looks very different than what it would look like in my household. Also, there are some things that are just a part of a person's personality and cultural practices, right? And sometimes our anxieties are, sometimes the manifestation of the anxieties and their behaviors may be based on irrational beliefs. But for some of my students, these beliefs are very rational, right? It's if the media is portraying, let's say, the rates of COVID, right? The transmission of COVID in certain areas, it may not be so high, versus if you're looking in Newark and you may have a 41% transmission rate, that's a very real reason for someone to be anxious. How students are navigating their educational spaces and their ability to successfully pass class. My seniors currently are experiencing and sharing high levels of anxiety because there's a fear of how do I, you know, successfully complete these classes in order for me to graduate. We're having a lot of schedule changes that are going on. How am I able to master all of this work in one particular day? Do an assessment, complete enough work. I may have to work and provide for family and know that I'm going to graduate. And then once I graduate, what is life going to look like outside of this space? So what I had in my head, my plan for college, career, or maybe military service, that's almost non-existent right now in that sense, for them graduating from school.
And right. what a lot of people don't realize is that there's a difference between what we call acute stress disorder, which is like an anxiety that's brought on by something very specific. Like it, you know, it could be like Kamisha said, like application, some very discrete thing that's in your life that, when it's overcome theoretically, the stress may go away. And then there's chronic long-acting anxiety, which a lot of young people suffer from as well, young and old suffer from as well. And a lot of people can rationalize, they can realize that their anxiety is not natural. These feelings are not natural, and that they're counterproductive to getting on with your life. But even if you recognize that the problem with anxiety is, even if you recognize that, you may not be able on your own to do anything about it. You may just say, I know this is wrong. I know I'm not supposed to feel like this, but what am I supposed to do? I think about it. I realize it, but these thoughts are coming into my head regardless. And so talk therapy or cognitive behavioral therapy, allows you to try to take an active role in recognizing when a symptom or when a problem is going beyond your control, and then what are the thoughts that you need to have in your head to try to get through that problem, to recognize, nope, this is an intrusive thought. I shouldn't be having this thought. What are the things I need to do to get it out of my head and to improve my mental health so it doesn't happen again? So there is the role of therapy.
I work in the music industry, so I have a lot of friends with severe mental illness. And one term that I've heard thrown around a lot is high functioning depression. Can you explain the difference between high functioning depression and is there just a regular form of depression? What does that all mean? And how do you see that unfold?
I mean, ostensibly, there's no difference. It's just somebody who may be a high achieving person to begin with that suffers from depression versus somebody who is not high achieving who suffers from depression. In my opinion, the way we would treat it would be the same. It just highlights the fact that you can actually suffer from depression and still be somebody who has, a six-figure salary and does, impressive work and has a strong standing in the community, yet you suffer from crippling depression, but you're able to get through it. To what extent that it's damaging your health, that's another story. But from my perspective, it's the same thing. It just highlights that you know, it's the same thing with alcoholism. Somebody can be a high-functioning alcoholic, right? But they're still an alcoholic. They still have somebody who has issues with substance abuse or alcohol, but they may be able to go to work. They may be able to do a really impressive job, and then they come home and they collapse, and they're dependent on that substance. So right. From my perspective, high-functioning, just from what you should take from it, is that it just shows that it affects everybody.
It's interesting, right. It's interesting because... people like to always are looking for ways to separate themselves, right? I'm not depressed. I'm high functioning depressed. Like, what is the difference? There's a difference because they were still going to treat it the same, right? Is that you are able to deal with yours differently than someone else's, but at the end of the day, you're still suffering the same way. And it's interesting, you know, I'm glad you brought that up, Dr. Longo, because there's a lot of people who are quietly suffering every day and are leading organizations, municipalities, households every day. And we literally do not know. They're like walking time bombs, ready to go off at a moment's notice. And so we have not, as a society, taken mental health very seriously. My perspective in this conversation is more about prevention and early stages of human development and mental development. And so I know both of you are in the spaces where you kind of are treating this issue or dealing with the issue that has arisen. But my focus has always been on how do we prevent that from even occurring and or identifying it early. And I just think that a lot of times we are, you know, a lot of it is cultural. I mean, Kamish, you mentioned that. I mean, that's the crux of it, especially in minority groups. Like, it's just no one says these things. No one talks about these things. There's no one in our family who is these things. And if they are, that's the one family member that nobody really wants to hear about when they start talking about psychology or clinical health. Oh, here she go again, or here he go again, right? So there's certain conversations that we just don't have. And that's just, you know, embedded a lot of into our cultures. The other thing is that I think that we can start the mental health prevention or mental health, helping with mental health early if we start having these conversations early. And, you know, when I talk to young people, they're people who are under the age of 16 are more willing and able to have conversations about a variety of different things. We just don't have those conversations with them because we think of it as a mature or adult conversation. But I think we need to think about how do we have conversations around just well-being. Right? Taking care of yourself. We do not have those conversations with young people because most times young people don't have issues, right? They don't have physical issues. They're not running around and, you know, their knees ain't hurting. They don't have arthritis, you know, things that cause the health conversations don't come up with groups at 10 years old, 11 years old. So, and I'm not saying that we shouldn't need to sit them down and say, okay, now we need to talk about mental health therapy for you, right? I'm not saying that. But I think that if we start having conversations around personal wellness and health, and maybe even when it comes down to what redefining the schools, right? Redefining what health class really is, right? Not just, all right, everybody, we're talking about the birds.
Don't do drugs.
Right. Yeah. You know, what is the health class supposed to look like now? And we need to start having that conversation early. So when the student is older, the idea of seeing the doctor isn't foreign. Now, the other piece is as minorities, we tend to look at people in authoritative as an authoritative figure as either a fear or respect. There is very few in between, right? And so we either fear our parents or respect our parents, right? And so we either fear the police or respect the police. We either fear our teachers or respect our teachers. Love sometimes develops over time based on how you view that fear or respect, but we're kind of rooted in these two dichotomies, right? So if you have a doctor is another authoritative figure that you either fear or respect, right? Not necessarily the individual, but what they represent, right? So if I'm going to the doctor, it's because something's wrong with me. If I'm seeing a police officer, it's because something's wrong with me. Right. And my mom calls me into the bedroom to talk to me. Oh, I must have done something wrong. Right. So it's always like this fear or respect thing. And so when we understand that, I think that also the medical industry has to approach people differently to understand that they are coming out of space where I'm only engaging with you because I have to. Right. And so my view of you is something where I'm afraid of what you're going to tell me. Or I respect the fact that you do this great job, right? And so it is relationship building, which people in many professions really do not engage in. And you have to do that at a very young age to develop the kind of relationships for not just for you and the customer, but for the client to be able to see others in that position in a different way. And also this goes down to parents, right? How are we training our children? Are we training our children to fear or respect us? Or are we training our children to understand the role that we play? And if we teach our children to start understanding things versus following instructions, more or less, then we can develop a relationship or help them develop their own understanding of what does the role of the doctor, what is the actual role of the doctor? Just like, what is the actual role of my mom? What is the actual role of my teacher? What is the actual role of my father, right? And so when they start thinking that way, then they'd be able to understand appreciate now why I should come speak or why I should come on my own accord without it there being like this now I have to do it. But just, you know what, let me just do a 6-month check-in, right, with my doctor. You know, let me just schedule a sit down with a psychologist to get some things off my mind, right? That's just something that we just don't do unless we have to. So I think that we start earlier and have these multiple conversations with young people early as well as parents early and get everyone to understand that dynamic, then I think we were on our way to preventing a lot of the issues from becoming issues.
And right. Lincoln, I'm glad you brought up prevention because that's one of my focuses. And I mean, this, you know, this different approaches, but one approach is you should see whether you're a pediatric patient or whether you're an adult patient, you know, you should see your provider, your doctor on a yearly basis, because then it's not just going to them when something's wrong. Then they know you, and then they can say, we do screening tests for depression, and we can say, you know, you seem off. You know, this is not how you were last year, or this was not how you were 6 months ago. And maybe that can be detected earlier. The other thing is that the society that we're living in is not exactly one that is friendly towards anxiety and depression the society that we're living in really fosters anxiety and depression because we're not living like humans were designed to live in a hunter-gatherer society with minimal stimulation. You know, now we're in an overstimulated world where everything is a dopamine hit, you know, in one way or another, you know, social media, getting likes, whatever it is, influence, getting the rush of high from a post, seeing what other people are doing, jealousy towards what other people are doing. It's really not natural. And I don't think the anxiety and depression crisis is going to go away unless that in some way is addressed, the social media is addressed. And it's just, you're trading a short-term high for a long-term, you know, disaster, so to speak. You know, it's very few people that can be chronic social media users that don't suffer any side effects from it. So it's not natural. And, you know, I don't have a good solution for it, but I see a lot of young kids that are very, very growing up, very addicted to the social media. I'm recognizing that that's going to be a problem, but I'm not sure society has a solution for that yet. Besides, yes, it's a problem. It's there and we should try to limit the use, but it's hard to enforce that.
And I will say, I know our focus is on young people, but adults in their 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s are on these platforms just as much, and they're suffering the same exact side effects, the jealousy factor, the, oh, my house isn't as big, or my, you know, my kids aren't doing as well. You know, there's a lot of that present on social media amongst the parents.
It doesn't go away.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting because when I first started working in this field, I said, you know, the biggest problem with people is that they're selfish, right? And selfishness meaning like they're only concerned about themselves and no one else, right? And then my cousin, who is a clinician, he's a psychologist. He has a practice. He was actually practicing, he was working at Rutgers as a contractor, but he has two practices, one in New Jersey and one in New York. And he was like, nope, that's not it, Lincoln. He said, the root of the issue is love. He said, when you go and you talk to these individual students and you peel back all the layers, you find out that they did not get the love that they needed when they were very young. And it manifests itself in these different ways that we're now seeing as adults. And so when we talk about the issues that we're seeing where everyone needs gratification, everyone needs something, what we're talking about is everyone needing to fill a void that is within them. And they're looking for, you know, they have 10 children, right? They're in and out of a dozen relationships. They're looking for likes. They're looking for gratitude. They're looking for someone to walk in and say good morning, even to them, to acknowledge them, right? Because that stems from early childhood issues that were never really addressed. And let me tell you, we talked about that last time about those bookmarks, right? You don't forget all the other moments in your life when your parents were just great. And then that one moment they said, my mom didn't come to my birthday, or, you know, I felt like she just let me down. You never got over that, right? And you never was able to talk about it too. And so because you were never able to talk about it, you're never able to heal. So it remained like this void, and you don't even realize that you have that void, right? You're just constantly trying to fill it and realizing you're never happy. You're never satisfied. No matter how many likes, no matter how much you're given, you're just never truly satisfied with the results. Because what you're looking for is something that none of us can give you, right? Except for someone guiding you through a self-healing process, which is where people like Kamisha, some other, you know, even Sierra, who's on our team, who deals with, you know, does exact same thing, but deals with young kids as well. But they're guiding them through a process of self-healing so they can first identify that the void is there, and then understand what that all that they've been doing and the problems that circulate around those problems have been related to that void that they've been trying to fill. We can't go in the past and fix that, right? We can't go in back in time and say, all right, mom, now I need you to fix that for me. But we can acknowledge that it exists and now start putting in steps to live a better life, understanding that that is what the reason why I was doing what I was doing in the first place.
And so I think those moments are like, those are powerful moments when a student has this cathartic experience or like, oh, so this is why I'm, you know, fighting everyone and cursing teachers out and coming to school mad. The challenge that I find, even at my own school, and I'm so appreciative to my principal, shout him out, Dr. Jose Aviles, who is very understanding and very focused on the emotional and social wellness of our young people for them to be successful academically, that there are a lot of adults standing in front of our young people that don't do this work themselves, right? So even when we did, our support team did a lesson for our staff and our students just about social emotional wellness, preparing for the holiday season for those that were partaking in that, was a little difficult for them because there are their own, you know, everyone comes with their own baggage. Right. I tell myself, I give myself a fanny pack worth of baggage to come to work with. Some people are not at that level of awareness. I have that benefit and that fortune because this is my profession. And some of our young people, they come with so much, and our adults come with so much. And it's very difficult to compartmentalize. So when you talk about these conversations at a young age, you know, I recognize in school when you're in kindergarten, your teacher is very nurturing and, you know, they're right there. They're helping you out through soiling yourself or walking to lunch, walking to class. By the time students get to fourth grade, their level of independence and navigating their social spaces and that connection to how nurturing teachers are it totally starts to plummet. By the time they're in middle school, you're probably more authoritarian in your communication with students than you are authoritative in early childhood. You know, you really want to engage them. And for some reason, I'm not sure, it just drops off. And our young people need to have that space to have conversations, because like Dr. Longo said, there is this very distorted perception of reality that social media presents. And our young people buy into it. Their music, what fashion looks like, you know, their body type, what their relationships or friends are like. And there are some people on social media, you know, I'm a recent TikTok lover, I have no shame in saying it, but they will talk about, you know, their traumas and their pains, you know, what they're experiencing. And our young people need to have the space, and our parents, the guardians, have to learn that. Right. When it comes to mental health in the Bible, it's just like, you know, you're presented with it and you just kind of like pray it away and it goes away, versus really dealing with the fact that Judas committed suicide. Like, he betrayed the one person that had the most loyalty to him, and he didn't know how to deal with that because the 11 other homies were looking at him like, oh, you gonna really do that to the Christ? He was like, I'm just gonna kill myself. Right. You had people, so many people in the Bible that are dealing with this. God heals the brokenhearted. Those are people that are dealing with depression. Like, how do I deal with that? I read this scripture, but with our religious leaders, how are we talking about how you deal with that? So I think in our school settings, I know our district is really, really pushing to have like a lot of social emotional learning lessons that are going on. But I think there has to be time and spaces with adults where they just are like, I can just be Kamisha. I don't have to be Miss Stewart. And I have to be able to do this in a safe place where I talk about a lot of the difficulties I'm experiencing. Right? We have our social justice curriculum, and we set aside once a week for teachers to get prepared to unpack the lessons. And a lot of people are dealing with a lot of discomfort talking about social justice, racism, oppressive, systemic discrimination. A lot of these things that are uncomfortable that in normal adult life, we may have like wings and sangria, and we just talk about it with our friends from a very subjective point. And so the same way with mental health, like, we don't need to be scared about talking about it. And we need to have people that are familiar with this. Dr. Longo, that is very intentional about doing this on a proactive platform. Clinicians such as myself that work with young people that are comfortable having these very personalized conversations at the table when you're designing these curriculums, when you're designing what this looks like. I understand the academic is important. I will never take that away. But a professional development day may need to be dedicated just to the wellness of adults, and not where people are feeling evaluated, right? There needs to be a space where we're really pulling in parents who are just living to survive, that don't have the time or the skill set to talk to their young people. And I have to check myself as a parent of four kids and, you know, two that are in the house, my 16-year-old, I'm just trying to live and get things done. And I have to get back, pull myself back and say, you know, one time I was getting on him about something. I'm putting the baby to bed. And, you know, I'm like, you know, Jamal, I need you to just go to your room and stop doing that. Like, it's becoming very frustrating. I'm like, why are you crying? Because you hurt my feelings. I'm like, on one hand, I appreciate the fact that my son has the language and the confidence to tell me, like, you hurt my feelings. On the other hand, I'm thinking, like, well, I need you to take care of this. But Kamisha, you still got to check in, right? Because this is going to be a young boy who is growing up, and he needs to be able to manage, identify, label, navigate through his emotions so he doesn't turn into a broken man, because that's going to be harder to address. And I feel like we put so much effort into the reactive work when the young people are not managing their emotions well, and they're not in class, and they're in special education, and their counseling is happening maybe here and there, or you're working with all of these different community partners and pulling the parent in, who, like you said, Lincoln, depending on, you know, how they're perceiving the other person at the end of the table, are, I'm coming in expecting you to fuss at me about why my child isn't going to class. How come he's not taking his medication? You know, you didn't talk to the case manager, and I keep calling you and not answering the phone. Well, I'm working two jobs. I'm trying to provide for my three kids while you're literally judging me because I have three kids and I'm not married. And I'm at this table and you're looking at my young child of color and wondering why he's not managing his emotions. Well, last I checked, you have the degrees and the certification. How are you teaching him how to manage his emotions? And where's the team that's on this side of the table with me, where I feel like, you know what, it's okay, I can try to get you some job support. There's a night class that you can take. You want to become a CNA? Let me try to help you out through there, versus on the other side of the table as critics.
That was you preached right there. Sister. Yeah, go ahead.
Absolutely. That
was, well said.
That was true. Now sit right. I mean that is the dilemma, and you know, and the reality is, even when we want to do, like yourself, Kamisha. I mean, you have your own life, you have your own children, you have your own layers of things that you're dealing with. You have your own past and your own parental things that traveled over to you, generational issues that come over with you. And they're just like, you know, when you're faced with a child that says that to you and kind of checks you at the same time when he says that, you have to say, okay, now my next step is very crucial here. How I respond to him right now could create a bookmark him that I'm now dealing with 20 years from now, right? So it's like, how do I do it? And it's not easy. And even with your skill set, you're still asking the same question. Imagine those who have no skill whatsoever, the 18-year-old parent, the 19-year-old parent, right? And so it is a struggle. And even for those who are on the other side of the table who want to not just call you in when there's a problem, who really want to support you, there isn't even the resources. You know, we're saying that even as RWA, there just isn't enough resources to do what we know needs to be done, which everybody you talk to, we have conversations like this with so many practitioners, right, Kamisha? I mean, everybody in the industry would say this isn't true. But everyone also say there's not enough resources to handle it. Like, there's just not, you know, and unless I'm literally going to be single for the rest of my life with no children and truly dedicate my entire existence to this work, like, there is not enough, you know. So it is a struggle, and that's why I kind of love the work that we're doing here, is that we're working with younger people every time, you know, trying to get them younger and younger and younger to avoid them from becoming the future that are so accustomed to seeing all the time. You know, it's critical to engage them at a young age.
And I really feel like part of our state curriculum should require content of this nature, right? You know, it doesn't take away from your Englishes, your maths, your U.S. history, but even within that U.S. history block, whatever that is, I think that each year students should be able or should be required to take something related to social emotional wellness in line with their development, as well as something related to social justice. Right. And if there's so much effort that's put on the front end, on the reactive end, I think we will find ourselves in a position where we're not so strained on resources. You know, if you're thinking in substance abuse, you're going to have and the reality is that a lot of things sometimes come down to money, you know, the economy of things. So if we are really investing in our young people at an early age where we're getting them used to having these conversations, like in kindergarten, there's such a big focus on I statements, how I'm feeling, what you did and how that impacted me, you know, and how we communicate common language with our young people, holding an accountability with our adults. It's very difficult for adults to apologize and say, you know what, I was wrong. I shouldn't have said that. I realized today I was telling my son, why are you putting on YouTube? Like, I need you to not put on YouTube. The TV's not for you. And my husband's like, he's putting on My Baby Can Read for the little one. And I was like, oh, I'm sorry. My bad. And it's like, I've gotten comfortable apologizing to my child. I can't think of too many times when my mother apologized. And my mother is phenomenal. Like, she is, listen, God made a mold and it was like, beautiful woman, Cynthia Pearl Mays. Hill Jackson, as I call her. Yes, it was her. But I also know we talk often of, you know, I was just trying to raise you to not relive these cycles, not be a part of these generational curses. I didn't want you to live in a family of addiction. I didn't want you, you know, to grow up and be an unwed mother and living in that house. I didn't want you to deal with the economic stress that I had to deal with. You know, so I understand that. But if we have these conversations and have parents involved early, because there are places and spaces and learning communities where parents show up. And that's like, it's just ingrained, right? In some traditional public schools, that's not the case. In some of our, you know, public charter schools, I see parents that are like, and I was one of them, 9 months, running to the building to make sure my son got there before 7:31. You know, and these are the same kids, same communities. But it's how are we making sure at an early age, what are non-negotiables? For our parent, that doesn't mean that their parent involvement may not be better than others, but what are some non-negotiables? Your child's mental wellness is a non-negotiable. The teacher's mental wellness is a non-negotiable. The school leaders having these conversations and the district respecting that are non-negotiables, because what I need at my high school is very different than what someone needs in the South Ward and in the East Ward or in Glen Ridge. And yes, we are under-resourced, but we have to have a focus of this, what we're talking about right here.
I totally agree. You guys are talking a lot about the necessity for institutional and systemic change to address this issue of mental health or lack thereof mental health. And Anthony, I want to get your take on this, and then Kamisha afterwards as well. Are there any strides being made in medicine and in education to integrate this conversation more so? And if not, are there any ways in which we can do that? For example, Anthony, you mentioned earlier the importance of an annual physical or a semi-annual physical. Does everyone also need a semi-annual mental check-in? And are there any strides being made for us to head in that direction?
Yes. So the annual physical is an important time where the physician can screen you for depression. And that was not always the case. Screening and talking about depression was not something that in the olden days that you would talk to your doctor about. He would be checking your blood pressure and maybe giving you, prescribing you aspirin or helping you treat a pneumonia or a sinus infection. But asking you about how you feel throughout the day and depression, that has come a long way. So medicine is slow to move. And although that should have been there longer, it is part of the annual physical. It is the chance to identify people who are at risk for depression, for suicide, for anxiety, and other mental health disorders, and to get them connected with a psychiatrist, psychologist, somebody who can be managing that. So the annual physical with the primary care doctor is the gateway, or the pediatrician for most of our population that is going through real world, at least from the high school end. And then depending if they still see a pediatrician through college or they see an adult physician, but regardless, that's the gateway for where a lot of people are screened for depression, screened for anxiety. Beyond that, there's a long way that medicine still has to go. There's
an education as well. And I'm sure you could speak to that, Kamisha, too.
You know, our district has a partnership with an organization, and we have a program for a rethink. And one thing I do like is that students were provided a self-assessment, and that gives some real data so that we can see students' ability to manage their emotions, seeing where their ego strength are, where their ego strength is, and just a lot of different areas. And that allows you by school to just kind of see maybe some of our ninth grade females are struggling in this particular area, and some of our 10th grade boys are struggling in this area. I think the virtual space makes it a little more difficult to try to create very engaging platforms for our young people, because they're just kind of like all WebExed out. But I appreciate that that is something that our district has done. One thing I think it's extremely important is that principals have some autonomy in order to create programming and practices that are unique to their building. Right. Like, so we have our social justice curriculum and advisory that we're working on. You think about the principal at Westside, Akbar Cook, who thought it was necessary just to create spaces for their young people to come to just wash their clothes. Right. To have they have like night gym time where students are not roaming the streets, and they can come into the building and do gym, do any type of sports, engage with people at a time in our city where you probably higher rates of homicides or crimes that are happening for young people between the ages of like 14 and 21. So you have a safe space for them to come in. So I think it's important for leaders to have that ability to recognize, like, what is it that I need in my building? What is it that I need? And create these partnerships where you don't have people that are having these strained relationships with law enforcement. And law enforcement doesn't have the same with young people. That when I see you, it should be like, oh, okay, what's up, Officer Stewart? How you doing? Oh, how's your mother? Oh, really? Your sister? Oh, yeah, I saw him at the barbershop. You know, like, you need to have that very personal relationship. So when you see them, there's this level of accountability that he's invested in my well-being, not invested in bringing up their quota and their stats.
Right. And this particular moment in time that we're in is totally unnatural for students with virtual learning. You know, I have little cousins who just started their first year in high school, and I feel so bad for them because that experience was completely ripped from them. So do you have any advice or any insight on how students can live a healthy life being succumbed to this virtual learning situation that we're in, and teachers as well? What's the best way to deal with that so that you maintain some level of social cohesion and so you don't feel isolated or depressed or confused? Is there a solution, or are there ways to remedy that?
So just key to what you just said, the isolation part, right? That really exacerbates some of the symptoms that they may have been able to manage in the past that are making it a little more difficult to manage. So logging into class, I don't think students realize how helpful and healing it is to log in and turn on a camera, right? If I was talking to a person and I only spent time just texting them, you know, it's a very disconnected experience. I'm having conversation, but it's disconnected. But there's something that is just very normalizing for us as people and how we engage and socialize when I can see you, right? I can't necessarily touch you because of the kind of where we are right now in our nation or just kind of in the world. But there's this ability to connect with you this way. It definitely helps out a lot. Another thing is creating a routine for yourself, because it's easy to just kind of like wake up whenever, go to sleep whenever. You're just kind of all over the place. And some of those things that impact how our young people are feeling, how our young people are dealing with some of their anxieties, their mood swings, the irritability, their sleeplessness is when they don't have a schedule. So putting yourself on a schedule. Also recognizing that they need to find that network of support. So for us in the building, it's the social workers we have by grade. It may be a friend that you just kind of connect with that keeps you involved. We have food pantry, and one of our 10th graders, our class president, is very big on the Instagram page. Like, hey, let's just get out to help other people. I think that interaction and feeling purposeful in these times where you things are so many things are uncertain definitely helps out. Utilizing like the I was sharing with my students, like a 5 minutes of me time. Do some things like some exercise, jumping around, just have a full out dance off to like music. Romero can come on, you know, whatever you want to listen to, just go out and just rock out, right? Just have some fun. Yeah. Cook a meal. Find something that you would like to cook. I learned how to make shrimp fried rice and general style chicken last night, you know, for my family. But something that they do, journaling, affirmation, mindfulness, a lot of different things that they can do. And I think those are like the biggest things for right now, just to make sure that they are not just kind of disconnecting so much. Because at one point we're going to be back in person, and it's going to be very difficult for people to just kind of reconnect, sitting in class, engaging with people. Conceptually, I think like, oh, I'll just go back to school and everything's fine. But if you literally have not been in contact with the 1600 people in the building, sitting and having a conversation with a teacher, engaging in some critical thinking, doing what we normally was, what socializing is, and thinking that you're just going to get back up, it's going to be overwhelming for you.
Right. And Lincoln, I want to get your take from a curriculum perspective. We've talked about this in the past, but in another potential catalyst for depression is not having some sort of interest or passion that gets you through the day. And I feel like one of the ways I've been able to navigate around those emotions is having a passion for music. So how do we engage students and adopt curriculums that incentivize that level of proactive, passion-based learning so that people are happy and excited to wake up in the morning?
Yeah, I think that before we even get to the passion piece, you have to build the person up internally. Right. So we kind of group this as into SEL training, right? A social emotional learning, when it's really just it being introspective, building up certain internal mechanisms within you. So one of the things, and because I had, now that I think about it, when I look back, well, not now, but when I look back at my previous times, it was a moment where I was depressed, and depression caused you to feel like you're hopeless. There's nothing you could do, right? But what got me through it was understanding my personal accountability, right? And understanding that if the longer I sit in this, the worse is actually going to be for me when I decide to get up out of it. And if I feel bad now, I'm going to feel 10 times worse in a week, right? Of just sitting here doing nothing. Because the world doesn't stop spinning, right? And that's just...
Yeah, but it couldn't have been that simple. How did you get out of it? Besides just tell yourself to get out of it.
But that's what it is, that simple once you're taught how to think in that way. That's my point. It's like, so
sure.
The hard part is teaching our young people how to be self-confident, right? Teaching them intrinsic skills. And like what I was saying, the social emotional learning piece, where it's asking them to think about who they are as a person. What do they want to be? You know, how do they see themselves? How to value themselves? How to love themselves? How to understand how their place in the world, as well as the world around them, understanding how the world functions, right? As it relates to them, right? So when, because part of it is also a consequence, right? Where I'm not, someone else is not no longer accountable for me. And what we have done for generations is kind of take away accountability from children and make, and they're now saying that someone else is responsible for who I am and what I am and why I'm in this situation. And so, and again, this is multifaceted, right? So yes, it is going to touch into your values and your, what you want to do, your passions, but there's a pathway to that. And so, yes, I can help someone. And a lot of people are, to your point, a lot of people are following their passion, but they're still dealing with the same issues, right? Some people are really love what they do, but they can't deal with the people around them, right? Or they can't deal with other aspects of what they're doing or their life, where maybe their work becomes the escape because they don't want to deal with what's going on at home. But they never want to say that the reason why they have the situation at home is because of the other things that they have never addressed in their own self. Because everything that we're doing is a reflection of who we are, who we feel, who we are and how we feel about ourselves. Like we get with certain people because of how we feel about ourselves, right? We put ourselves around certain individuals. We allow ourselves to go down this particular pathway because of how we feel about ourselves. So yes, passion does help. Absolutely. But it also can serve as, if we are truly in our passion and really love what we do, it can also be a medication for the other issues. So yeah. I'm always about finding the root issues and tackling that. And so if we're not building up our children's self-confidence, self-awareness, self-love, then it doesn't matter how much passion they have for something. They're always going to have this issue at some point in their lives that's very impactful, whether in their family lives or personal lives. But, you know, so it's not just the passion does come in, but we definitely have to deal with the individual intrinsically.
Right. Right. Well, it's been an intense conversation. I thank all of you for joining us. And Anthony, I don't know if you had anything else to close out the interview from a medical standpoint, but do you have any advice as a clinician for people who maybe are embarrassed to see a doctor or who don't know how to articulate themselves or who are feeling lost and depressed during this, you know, crazy time in our lives?
Yeah, you know, you need to seek support from the community. Where you feel comfortable with, whether that's your priest, whether that's your parents, whether that's your teacher, counselor, and they may be able to give you the support you need and maybe help you become more comfortable with the idea of talking to a doctor or mental health professional. But it needs to start with somebody who cares about you that is recognizing those symptoms are an issue and will help you get the help that you need. And unfortunately, not everybody has that person. And hopefully, as a society, we will continue to allow more young people to have that person in their life.
Yeah, and Kamisha, from a student's perspective, for someone who maybe doesn't have a lot of clarity on first steps they could take, and if they don't have someone who they're comfortable talking to, do you have any words of wisdom for them?
I definitely just recognize that the struggles that you have are struggles that a lot of people endure. right? And we have not gotten this far. Like I say, I drink heavy from a well that I did not dig. So never feel that the struggles and the challenges and the obstacles that you're facing are counting you out for success in life. We all need somebody at 43. I need to have someone there because I have these dark spaces I go to. They have these areas where my self-esteem is low, where I am second-guessing my ability. And so the same way that adults need this to move further into our adulthood successfully, it's important that you have that. Sometimes if you're not comfortable talking to an adult, a peer that is in a space where you desire to be, that it's progressive, that is successful, outgoing, that person can also connect you. But I promise you, there are more adults that are cheering for you and receiving you with open arms and wanting to help you and help you be comfortable and successful than you can imagine. So definitely reach out to those as well. And know that this is a space that you don't have to stay in, like Lincoln mentioned before, because the longer you stay in, the harder it's going to be to get out of. And it can be greater later. Just work on taking it step by step. You don't have to tackle the whole monster at one time. You tackle small pieces and you build up small parts of yourself, your self-esteem, you know, better communication with peers. Those small things that you'll find when you look back, you've made greater progress than you realize.
Absolutely. Thank you all for joining us. And thanks, everyone, for listening. And we'll tune in next time for episode 8 of the Keeping It Real podcast by Real World Academy.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Keeping It Real podcast by Real World Academy. If you're a student looking for a mentor or a parent looking to help your kid design a happy life and a successful career, visit our website at realworldacademy.org and subscribe to us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and wherever you listen to podcasts to hear more exclusive content on how to design your future.